Ray Light, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
My pleasure, Cindy.
It's so nice to finally talk to you. I know we've been trying to work this out for months.
Yes, we have.
We finally got it going.
And before you get started with me, let me just say that you were one of the few heroes, in my view, that's been produced in the struggle of the working class and the oppressed peoples in the United States in this last 60-year period in which U.S. imperialist hegemony has morphed into the U.S. empire. So I'm really pleased to be with you.
Oh, thank you. And it's through this struggle that I have realized that I am in the working class, and I am a campaigner for these struggles all over the world. You know, I grew up in the empire, and I was always told that I was middle class, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And that if I worked hard enough, I could worm my way up into the 1%. And you know all that bullshit.
Yes, I do. So, yeah, in fact, just to respond to that, unfortunately, the leadership of the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win unions in the United States just about prohibit their leaders from talking about the working class. They only talk about the middle class. And what I resent about that is there's the idea that middle-class people are entitled to a decent life, but not that working-class people are entitled to a decent life. So at the Democratic National Convention in 2012, Bob King, the president of the United Auto Workers Union, started to say working class, and he realized he was making a big error because the Democratic Party absolutely forbids this term to be used at all. And he immediately said working families, because they'll say working families and they'll say middle class. Mm-hmm. But the idea that the working class, the people who actually build and move this world, should be entitled to have a decent life
right.
is too radical a notion for the Democratic Party. And tragically, it's too radical a notion for the leaders of organized labor as well.
Absolutely. Well, Ray, you're the general secretary of an organization called the Revolutionary Organization of Labor.
USA.
USA.
Right.
And I would like you to tell us a little bit about the organization and its goals.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said a little bit, because the organization is still a little organization,
right.
unfortunately. And we're faced with this, the big monster. I'm thinking of the Spanish word, but I don't know that I could say it correctly, but that the monster. And we are in the belly of the beast, desde las entrañas. And so the tasks, the revolutionary tasks of the United States are immense. Our organization is very small. We by ourselves are certainly not up to that task, but we also don't believe that a vanguard, an advanced detachment of the working class, can make the kind of revolutionary change we need in the United States. That for that to be accomplished, it takes the working class and the oppressed peoples within this multinational state. And so our task today is to help the working class learn through its own experience and our own experience of struggle with capital, that we need a revolution. And that's kind of the last thing that that the people and the workers try. They try everything else first. And unfortunately, at a time when the leadership of organized labor is absolutely enthralled to the Democratic Party, where the working class and the oppressed peoples are being forced over and over again to go through the same experience rather than leading from one experience to the next. Although Ferguson, Missouri, is an indication that the masses of the people, the working class, are beginning to learn who their real enemies are. So that's an encouraging development after a tragic event.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit about the organization. It's small, and the tasks are big, and the goals are really to help to achieve a socialist revolution in the United States, and to contribute to the achievement of a socialist world. as long as we have capitalism driving the humanity, dominating humanity, then the drive toward bigger and more destructive wars and the drive toward ecological and environmental disaster is moving at an accelerating pace because capitalism is now in its monopoly stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so the working people of the world are faced really with a choice over this next generation or so of either eliminating capitalism or having this world as we know it, this Mother Earth, become uninhabitable for the human race.
Right.
So that's so our goal is to help to overthrow capitalism in the United States and the world and save this Mother Earth for the human race and for indeed for the animals and other natural
all life.
Phenomena, all life on Earth, yes.
Well, we know the planet will continue.
Yes, the planet
with
will
with or without us,
that's right?
That's right,
exactly.
One of our friends, I recently, he said something very poetic. He said the Democratic Party is like a noose around the necks of the working people of this country.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought
and
that was
and
very
And I think
poetic.
You're aware of the fact that that our organization I'm pleased that as the leader of that organization, I've written from the very beginning of Obama's candidacy that he would be a more formidable leader of the empire than, for example, McCain, and which made him a more formidable adversary for the 99% and for the working people of the United States and the world. And unfortunately, that concept that he was such a danger was not widely understood internationally or nationally. I know some German comrades that I had spent time with during that 2008 election were marveling at the fact that the German people considered that they were voting for Obama, that Obama was their candidate. And
yikes.
I mean, the whole idea that this Democrat, who had originally started as a flunky for the Daily Machine forces and trying to knock out a progressive black congressman, Bobby Rush, that he was going to represent anything other than more of the same, only instead of an inept Bush, he was going to be a quite impressive manager for the empire in its brutal oppression of the peoples of the world. That there wasn't any basis for that illusion. So that's all I guess I want to say about that. But yes, the Democratic Party is there to keep the working class and the oppressed peoples from learning from the bitter experience.
Yeah.
You know. So I mean, we went literally in a sense around the world.
So, Ray Light, the Revolutionary Organization of Labor is an internationalist organization. And what is the importance of the link between working people and oppressed peoples around the world?
Great question. The working class of the United States faces the capitalists of the United States. But even looking at it only from the point of view of the working class of the United States, the enemy that we face, the adversary that we face, draws its strength from the fact that it's able to super exploit peoples all over the world, oppressed peoples and their resources and their labor all over the world. And I mean, one of the extreme examples of just how much of a parasite U.S. imperialism is on the oppressed peoples is the fact that we now witness parents in Central America sending their children to the United States. I mean, this is the kind of desperation that it's led to. So that's just an example of the extent to which the U.S. Empire has been able to draw strength from their super exploitation of the peoples and the working class of the oppressed nations. And that leads to a situation where the workers in the United States have been overwhelmed by their adversary. So even from that narrow perspective, the working class of the United States needs to establish strong links with the rest of the international working class and the oppressed people.
Mm-hmm.
In order to have an opportunity to meet the our ruthless adversary with any kind of strength. So that's really the first thing. And then the Soviet Union, which we may get into a little bit, in our view, was a tremendous success story. The capitalist revolution in the world, which mainly was spearheaded in Germany, France, and Britain,
mm-hmm.
took 100 years or so in each country to actually come into real power, where it became the unchallenged, virtually unchallenged power in each country. And that was merely replacing one form of economy that was based on the exploitation of, the term man by man, but the exploitation of people by other people,
mm-hmm.
By another one. So the whole question of fundamental change in human nature wasn't involved to a significant degree in that process. So here, the Soviet Union, that was founded in the end of 1917, was really only the second attempt. In Paris, in mm-hmm. 1871, there had mm-hmm. been the Paris Commune, which mm-hmm. lasted a couple of months. And that was brilliantly successful until it was drowned by the counter-revolution.
Right.
But then, so the question of the Soviet people and all, it was a remarkable success story in it, because it ended with after the unprecedented brutality of the Nazi invasion and all. As Churchill said, no people on earth had ever been attacked so ferociously, and no people on earth could have reversed that and become triumphant as mm-hmm. the Soviets were.
Mm-hmm.
So now, get me back to your question, because when I start thinking right. about the heroism of the Soviet people, I kind of get caught up.
Well, earlier we were talking a little bit about how organized labor and the empire, representatives of the empire, don't ever say working class. And, my opinion, it's because they don't want the people of the world to have class consciousness, because if people in the working class, in the empire, in the working class, start thinking of the other people in other countries as their brothers and sisters, as members of their own class that are being sent to murder other people and die for members of the capitalist class, then wars would end. And so that's why I think that consciousness is so important, and that struggle.
Well, you're focused. As I said, you're one of my heroes, but your focus is on ending war, and my focus is on the working class achieving power. Now, of course, we're
and that
not.
Would end war.
It would end war. It would end war. But I'm just saying, and they're not at odds.
Well, no,
but
not
the,
at
but
all.
The emphasis uh-huh. is a little different. And so I think that the question of, for example, our goals as the Revolutionary Organization of Labor USA, to establish socialism,
mm-hmm.
because it's the working class of people who have the capacity to run this world
mm-hmm.
on a fair and just basis, including achieving an equality of nations. I remember Malcolm X was very clear on the idea that if you integrate, Malcolm X pointed out that when you integrate two forces, one of which has power and the other which has none. All that is oppression. It equals oppression. And so as long as capitalism continues in its monopoly stage, in its imperialist stage, one of the main characteristics of it is to continue to foster the inequality between a few powerful nations and hundreds of, at this point, really billions of people in the nations, at this point, many of them in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, on the other hand. So there's this huge inequality between and among nations. So one of the positive things about the socialist revolution, as we see it, as we envision it, is that we will achieve an equality and equality of nations. And it's not only as we see it, but the Soviet experience showed that it was possible. First, there was the unity of the working class of Russia, the mother country, with the oppressed peoples. And Russia used to be, under the Tsar, was called the prison house of nations. And so the working class of the mother country, mainly located in a few cities led by St. Petersburg and Moscow, carried on their shoulders the struggle of the liberation of the peoples all over the Russian Empire that were oppressed by the Tsar. And then, once the working class achieved power with the Great October Revolution in 1917, you had the alliance that was formed with Sun Yat-sen, the head of the rising Chinese bourgeois republic, because the Soviet Union was the only country that treated China with respect, and Sun Yat-sen responded to that. It was the beginning of a what could be a beautiful friendship, and only really the intervention of the fascist Axis prevented us from seeing an even greater flowering of the within the Soviet Union. Again, once the workers achieved power, there were tremendous and Stalin was the who himself was from an oppressed nation, the oppressed nation of Georgia, was the first minister of nationalities in the Soviet government, and the Soviet government under Lenin and Stalin took great pains where there were oppressed peoples in Tsarist Russia who didn't even have a written language. Soviet government took pains to help develop that written language, to help cultivate the cultures of these nationalities. So even within the Soviet Union, there was already this effort that was quite successful to develop the equality of the nations within the Soviet Union, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
We're going to need to talk to you further on another occasion because I know I would really like to talk about the factionalism of socialist and communist organizations, but not today, you know, but because that's like a huge topic.
Sure.
But the Revolutionary Organization of Labor describes itself as a Marxist-Leninist organization. And I think most people who are in the, you know, in that struggle understand that. In my own life, in my own activism, in my own family, when Stalin is mentioned, the first thing that comes out of most people's mouth is Stalin was a monster. And can you... Of course, I've never really believed propaganda of the empire, even when I was a little kid. But especially since my son was killed, especially since I've been able to travel the world, go to places like Cuba, which is exactly opposite of anything I've been told about Cuba my entire life. I was born in 1957. So, you know, my entire life, Castro and Che and Cuba were evil. Let's talk, but of course now I know the exact opposite is true. So talk to us about the demonization of Stalin and why that's not true either.
Okay. If it's okay, I just want to say a word about Cuba.
Okay.
And that is that what we know about Cuba and what the imperialist media has had a hard time concealing from the people of the United States, even though for most people they still don't know it, is that Cuba has one of the most effective healthcare systems in the entire Western Hemisphere. And it has about the highest literacy rate in the entire Western Hemisphere. And if Castro was such a dictator, and now his brother Raul, if they were such dictators, why would they make sure that the masses of the people of their country could read and write?
Right.
And that's one of the main weapons that's used by oppressors to keep the people down, is to keep them in ignorance. And in our country, just, and I'll just say this one more thing, look at in our country. Under Reagan, there was a crisis declared in education. I think William Bennett was his Secretary of Education. Since Reagan and Bennett, the public education in the United States has been on a rapid decline. So what is it that Bush and Obama and these people are afraid of with a literate population? So I just want to compare. And then the healthcare system.
And that's what Chavez said. You know, Hugo Chavez said an educated people are an engaged people. And he wasn't afraid of educating his populace.
Right. And he learned a lot from Fidel.
Okay. So let's get back to Uncle Joe.
Yes, Uncle Joe. Well, Joseph Stalin, as you, Cindy, put it so well about Fidel Castro in Cuba, why would the imperialists, when they control the mass media, want the people of the United States to know that that socialism works, that the Soviet Union, not the United States, was the main force in the defeat of world fascism, and that the leader of the Soviet Union during that entire period was none other than Joseph Stalin? So in 1943, when this was actually taking place, Stalin was Time magazine's Man of the Year. But after the war, immediately after the war, the U.S. ruling class had to separate the U.S. people from the Soviet Union and Stalin. That was summed up in the words of GE's Charles Wilson, who I believe was Secretary of the Treasury right after the war, when he said that the two enemies of the United States, which he meant the U.S. 0.1% enemies, were the Soviet Union abroad and the labor movement at home. And so he was pretty clear. Unfortunately, the labor movement didn't realize that meant, and our best friend is the Soviet Union, and it happens to be led by Joseph Stalin. But so the reason for the demonization is, like the reason for just about everything else in capitalist society, is the profit motive of the capitalist. Stalin, I said already, had played a key role in the uplifting of the oppressed peoples within the Soviet Union. He played a key role in the defeat of world fascism. When his daughter, Svetlana, moved to the United States, if you read her statements, her big complaint about Joseph Stalin was he didn't give his family favored treatment. Well, we supposedly want that in our public servants. That was who he was. I wish that I had brought with me a copy of the great poem, the epic poem by Pablo Neruda, in which he discusses the Soviet Union and Stalin in the period. And that poem is called "Let the Rail Splitter Awake." And it's a poem in which Pablo Neruda tries to help educate the ignorant masses of the United States on what the real situation in the world is. And so,
good luck with that, Pablo.
Exactly. But at any rate, the Neruda himself was most likely murdered, even though he was an old man, during the CIA-led overthrow of Allende, because by then Neruda, I think, was a senator from the mining district in Chile, and he goes as well as being a world famous poet. But kind of an ironic ending for the man who was trying to reach out to the people of the United States to educate us. So, but it, okay, on the question of Stalin, those are the reasons for the demonization.
Well, it also coincided with the red baiting and McCarthy witch hunts.
I'm very familiar with those. Yeah. I remember answering the door to the federal marshals when I was a little boy and Yikes. Stuff like that. Yeah, and my father was, you know, prevented from being able to work and support his family during that period. So I remember it well. It did coincide with that, and that was in line with what GE's Charles Wilson had to say. I mean, it was the attack on the labor movement in the U.S. But that demonization, it's like your experience with Fidel Castro in Cuba should help your audience to deal with this question.
Well, that's a special Labor Day edition of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I hope it was able to shed light by Ray Light on the working class struggle and the working class struggle as connected to the struggle of oppressed peoples all over the world. And I hope some of the force-fed propaganda was dispelled and some of those myths about the USSR were dispelled in your minds. And I hope you do further research, and just if we've learned anything, don't take the Empire's word for anything. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer Don DeBar, my production assistant Dee Dee Miller, Ray Light for sitting down with me to do this interview, and you for listening and supporting the show. Happy Labor Day. Peace out for now. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.